Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. At any given time, roughly 2.3 million people are incarcerated in the United States. They live an existence that is largely unknown to those of us on the outside. A new three-part animated series called The Zoo tries to show us how confusing and disorienting prison life can be. Here is narrator Michael K. Williams from the first episode.
Welcome to the Zoo, a term coined by one prisoner who felt being incarcerated was like living in the Twilight Zone. The Zoo is not a place you can point to or a system you can fight. It's the result of quixotic, arbitrary moves by prison wardens and staff that inmates can rarely prove or defend themselves against.
Getting these short videos produced took nearly 3 years and a lot of vision, and they are compelling. We'll talk with the creators this hour on Point, Life Inside Prison. First today from San Francisco is Patrick Doolittle. This story really starts with him. It was his 2017 Yale senior thesis that was called The Zoo, Disorientation and Retaliatory Disorientation in American Prisons. That paper led to journalistic organizations, The Marshall Project and First Look Media's animated video series. Patrick, thanks for being here. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
So you started this whole thing with your senior thesis at Yale. Tell me a little bit about how you came to write about life inside prison.
That's right. Well, so the thesis was inspired by actually an internship I had the summer after my junior year in college working as essentially a violent crimes investigator for public defenders in New Orleans, which was, you know, just quite an experience on every level. But a big chunk of it was actually spent in jail with our clients and in some instances in assisting them as they actually attempted to navigate the jail and justice system bureaucracies that, of course, I ended up writing about. So I went back to school in August 2016, started writing, but, you know, had some concerns about legality and other issues when it came to actually, you know, using specific client stories from the summer as source material. Mm-hmm. But I was adamant about the sources for the paper being the words and stories of inmates themselves, you know, not professors or pundits or even journalists. So, you know, I went looking for sort of comparable source material, and that's when and sort of why I found the American Prison Writing Archive and just began reading from there.
Mm. And that a prison American Prison Writing Archive is this huge archive of letters from prisoners. And I'm curious how you discovered themes in those writings. And did you anticipate what you found when you were searching through the archives?
Not at all, actually. So I just started reading, really. So I read hundreds of them. And what I found was just this incredible uniformity across these essays when it came to actually how these inmate authors were characterizing the experience of being in prison. So many of them describe that experience the exact same way, which is as being in this kind of prolonged state of total disorientation. That's what stuck out, this idea of a kind of disorientedness, you know, that rather than aggression or frustration, anger, even just lack of freedom, the primary quality they identified was like confusion, disorientation, just having no sense of what's true and what isn't. And that's, of course, you know, where the essay and the videos get their name, the Zoo, short for the Twilight Zone, which is this kind of suspended, surreal state, which makes them feel totally helpless, you know, like they have no agency at all. And that's just it, right? It's when you dig a little deeper, you find that, you know, it's not just the result of their confinement, this disorientation. It's not just a symptom or a byproduct of it. It's really instilled and imposed deliberately by prison administrators and bureaucracies. Like, it is the machine. It's not a bug in the machine. That's what sort of really shocked me, that these administrators have discovered that basically the most helpless subordinate state is the state of uncertainty and confusion, and that there are calculated kind of ways they can impose that state as a means of subordinating inmates and thereby, you know, making them more manageable.
What do you hope others will learn by watching The Zoo, this animated video series? Why should people care?
Well, I think a big part of it is that, you know, this disorientation, this kind of adrift, unsettled state, the nonsensical kind of unfollowable rules that set it in, that impose it, that instill it, they're a huge part of why people, our justice system doesn't rehabilitate people who go to prison. You can't rehabilitate inmates who feel this kind of instilled, imposed, deliberately calculated kind of adrift state, you know, as a means of subordination. They're not open to the lessons of any of the engagement classes, any of these kinds of things that are offered by the prison, you know, in the name of rehabilitation, which, of course, are really these kind of just Potemkin setups to, have the cover of rehabilitation while what's really going on is simply oppression and confinement.
Patrick Doolittle, joining us from San Francisco. His senior thesis at Yale was the origin for the animated videos called The Zoo. Patrick, thank you so much for starting us off here. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on again.
Thank you. Joining me now from New York is Lawrence Bartley. He's director of News Inside for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit journalism organization that focuses on criminal justice. He was involved in helping to write and produce the video series The Zoo. Lawrence, welcome to On Point.
Oh, hello, Jane. Thank you for having me.
It's so great to have you. Let me play a clip from The Zoo before we start here. This is one prisoner explaining how inmates must decide every morning where they wish to go that day. At around 5:30 a.m., a guard walks by, making a list of who wants to go where. In this clip, we hear how, if you miss getting on the list, it can haunt you all the way to the parole board.
In most facilities, the officer taking the list speeds by in the dark while people in their cells routinely state,
"Mess hall, yard, school, vocational, hospital."
As the officer looks straight ahead and robotically records each person's request. If you are still asleep or hesitate and therefore miss the zoom by a nanosecond, you are out of luck. A few hours later, when a new officer has begun a shift, cells begin to open. The inmates who miss the list begin yelling in an attempt to get the officer's attention. The officer normally yells back,
"You're not on the list!"
Then goes in the office to write a misbehavior report for refusing to attend programs. This can be held against the inmate when seeking release at the parole board.
Lawrence Bartley. It's a really fascinating and interesting look inside prison life today. To your mind, why is this an important project, The Zoo, Lawrence?
It gives voice and reality to some of the things that go on inside of a prison that people have been clamoring about for a very long time. I always say that incarcerated people are like an invisible population, even though there's about 2.3 million of them, because largely they believe that no one cares what they have to say. And while incarcerated, they're like the lowest of the lowest of class of a citizen. And it's very easy for people incarcerated to develop feelings of despair and sometimes even believe it. That clip that you just played, it's so true, and I went through that myself for many, many years.
Yes.
I was unfortunately incarcerated at the age of 17, and I did 27 years and 2 months. And even I've been out for nearly 2 years. And that Zoom by occurs about 5:30 a.m. And at 5:30 a.m., I'm up every day. Still, it's something ingrained in me to make sure that I'm up at that time. So it has these long term, lasting effects. And I like for not only incarcerated people to know that their stories and their woes are being told. I would like guards to hear this, or prison administrators to hear this, because there's these little subtle rules or practices that go on that create this psychological imbalance, and it doesn't have to be. There's different countries like Norway that operate their prison mm-hmm. systems in a different way, a more progressive way, and all these little nuances that are illustrated in The Zoo don't happen. So,
you know, Lawrence, I can understand, and I imagine that there are some listeners who are wondering, you know, I'm sorry that it's hard in prison, but those people deserve what they get. And they've done some horrific things, and this is the consequence for that. What's your response, Lawrence?
First, I would say I would never discount, you know, victims of crimes. They understandably should not have been victims. So I don't want to act like people incarcerated should be held up in a higher regard than someone who is a victim of a crime. A wrong is a wrong, and people should be accountable for it. And there's many people that I know who have been incarcerated who personally hold themselves accountable and are remorseful for the things that they have done. But still, I don't buy into the whole punishment aspect of incarceration. As I started to talk about earlier, those different countries like Norway, when a person comes in, they try to find out why the person committed that crime and to correct whatever's going on in that person's life and in that person's mind so that person won't commit that act again. But in the United States, unfortunately, for decades and decades, we've been punishing people, developing these negative feelings within them, and then that's why we see sometimes people come out on parole and they commit new crimes. Mm. So that's why I like the Zoe to kind of illustrate these different aspects of it so we can kind of stop doing those things.
Mm. Let me play another clip from the Zoe. In the first part of the series, we hear about how something as simple as laundry can cause real distress in prisoners.
Once a week, an officer arrives to distribute fresh linens. You must be present in your cell, but he never comes at the same time of day. He announces it on the intercom, but the sound is often drowned out by the noise of the facility. If you miss it, you don't get clean sheets.
The problems seem mundane at first. Missing out on fresh laundry is hardly a crisis, but this arbitrary timing is enough to drive them to distraction, leaving them constantly off balance.
We'll hear more from the Zoe after the break. These are anecdotes from prison letters kept in the American Prison Writing Archive to explore the role that life in prison has for 2.1 million people that are incarcerated in this country. We are discussing life in prison in this new three-part video series called The Zoe. More after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing life in prison in a new animated video series called The Zoe. Lawrence Bartley is with me. He's the director of News Inside for the Marshall Project. Lauren, as you mentioned, you spent 27 years in prison, so this project is very personal for you. I'm curious how Patrick Doolittle's thesis from Yale University found its way to you and the Marshall Project.
Well, Patrick Doolittle's professor, she sent it over in May 2017 to our former editor-in-chief, Bill Keller. And, you know, it was a 96-page thesis that she thought was great. And she said, if I could have given this an A+, I would have. And so Bill took it and found interest in it. So we wanted to, you know, we at the Marshall Project, we publish criminal justice related news, and we wanted to do something with it. But of course, we couldn't do something with a 96-page thesis. But as far as text wise that we normally do, the articles we write. But we figured that we can make it into an animated series. Mm. And we got lucky enough to get people like Topic on board and the award-winning, you know, animated cartoonist Molly Crabapple. And they started working on this project. So I joined the Marshall Project maybe a year or 2 years after they had started working on it. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the project had stalled a bit because there are three sections of it. And the three sections have a theme, the induction, adaptation, and retaliation. But each of the themes must intersect. And the anecdotes used must intersect as well. And there were some holes in it missing. And also I was asked to go through the archive to kind of pull out some of the stories and kind of vet them for truth based upon my experience. Mm. But I when I started to do that, I realized I didn't have to because I have some stories of my own and experience of my own that I can put in. Mm. So I put some of my experience in there and I wrote some and I helped them put it together. And then the end product is what you see today. Mm.
It's wonderful. Lawrence, hold on just a moment. Let me bring in now from Clinton, New York, Doran Larson. He's professor of creative writing and literature at Hamilton College. He's taught inside prisons for many years. He also started the American Prison Writing Archive, which is an open source archive of essays from incarcerated people. He's editor of Fourth City, Essays from the Prison in America. Doran, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So it was your archive that Patrick Doolittle accessed in order to write his thesis at Yale back in 2017, mm-hmm. which led to The Zoe, this extraordinary video series. I'm curious what this series means to you. What do you believe it portrays?
What strikes me about The Zoe, as someone who has been with the archive from the beginning, is the fact that what The Zoe represents really is an example of what the archive does that has not really been done before, and that is to represent the prison system from those on its receiving end at a scale that's really, hasn't been possible before digital technology existed. That said, the important things that The Zoe reveals are only, one piece of, quite large essay. In fact, an archive. The archive is actually over twice the size that it was when Patrick wrote his thesis. Mm. And at the same time that it reinforces the things that are presented in The Zoe, it also fills in, many other fields and dimensions of the experience of incarceration. And since incarcerated people write about more than just their experience in prison, it also represents, opens up testimony about the criminal justice system, about problem homes, broken communities, everything that people experience on the way to incarceration, as well as their time inside.
So what have you learned from the archives, from the American Prison Writing Archive? What has stood out to you, Doran?
I guess, if you're talking about a sort of, 30,000-foot view, that in the U.S. we have remarkable tolerance for poverty and domestic violence and the breakdown of communities, and but we have very little tolerance for the despair the people fall into and the way they respond to that despair coming out of those communities and those sorts of issues. I'm also struck by the, the sort of desperate generosity of writers from inside. These are folks who are really, quite desperate to establish their full humanity because they fully understand how little of that is allotted to them, credited to them by the public. And they want to establish the fact that they're fully human beings, no matter what they've done, and despite the circumstances that are rather conditions they're subjected to. And also quite generous in the sense that it's very few writers who write exclusively about their own conditions or their own experience. They see their own experience as representative of the experience of literally tens of thousands, millions of other people. And it's clear that they have the impulse not just to get their own stories out, but to get those stories out so that we understand more about the system itself and the suffering that's being undergone by so many other people around them.
Let me play another clip from The Zoe. In this clip, we hear about confusing prison rules that inmates must learn to navigate. Here it is.
Prisoners are asked to speak up when they see that an officer is corrupt or a prisoner is being mistreated or abused, but then are punished for bearing witness.
I was serving time in Texas when a guard asked me if I witnessed another guard sexually assaulting a prisoner. Assuming I would be protected from my testimony, I told the guard I was indeed a witness to the sexual assault. When the accused officer filed disciplinary charges in retaliation to the witness testimony, I was put into solitary confinement for 3 years, remaining in the SHU long after the accused officer was fired. The warden promised to intervene on my behalf, but reneged after I got my hopes up. After I was released from solitary, I was summarily shipped to another prison without warning.
Lawrence Bartley, your response to that clip, that part of the Zoe.
I can see something like that happening because of the politics of prison. Even though there may be some guards, or the guards in that instance, who took down the complaint and exacted some type of retribution from the officers for partaking in whatever they were doing, there are politics in place that make the different prison officials support one another. A person can write a grievance who's incarcerated and be right, but then the grievance will never go anywhere. A person can have all the evidence to prove what he or she says is factual, but the prison administration would always support the officer in the end. And it's just a culture, like they call it it's a version of the blue wall of silence you see with the police department. But it's something like that. I don't know what kind of wall of silence we would call it for correctional officers. It's one of those type of things.
Oh, let me get a caller on this point, Lawrence. Here's John in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for the welcome, and thank you for being on the program, and thank you for the light that you two are shining out. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Go ahead.
All right. I got on and started listening when the gentleman had mentioned about some success stories in other countries. That's an instance, and there is a response naturally, if it's fear based, and that is to say, aren't these prisoners don't deserve, you know, first class treatment, la la la. What we forget about the workers, the administrators,
yes,
behaving really well and understanding the situation and policy that makes them learn to behave better, because they're going home with a predator response to prisoners. They're taking that into their home and into their community. No blame here. Let everybody grow and be healthy. Shine the light. It's just the truth.
John, thank you. Actually, Doran Larson, jump in here.
Sure.
Lawrence talked about the politics of prison. What does the Zoe teach us about that, given this clip that we just heard?
I think what that's representing is the fact that we have virtually no oversight of how prison staff do their jobs. That's in part because incarcerated people have been so badly demonized that the public has generally, you know, ceased to care what the treatment is that's inside. That said, I mean, one of the things that's also, I think, important to keep in mind is that many of those behaviors can be the function of the fact that we have incarceration at mass scale, but also on the cheap. And what I mean by that is that staff in prisons are badly outnumbered compared to Northern European prisons, where staff-to-inmate ratios can literally be 1-to-1. Sometimes more than 1-to-1 with counselors and others that are there. In the U.S., we really try to minimize, just in terms of cutting costs, the number of staff relative to the number of people who are incarcerated. That puts staff in a position, basically in a seized position, where they have to sow a sense of intimidation and fear in order to control that large a number of people, right? Mm-hmm. So the confusion that comes about is both, you know, because there's really no accountability, you know, nobody really cares about that. But those effects of that outnumbering means that people who are in the positions of running the prisons are really sort of working from positions of disadvantage all the time. We need more training. We need much more training for people who work inside. We need smaller prisons, first of all, so that they can be managed by the number of staff they have. But you'll note that when you see stories about horrible violence taking place, stories coming out of Alabama recently and Mississippi, mm-hmm. The bottom line there is always understaffing. That's a sort of baseline problem that you have, and it leads to many of the other issues that we have as well. And you could do that two ways, reduce the prison population or increase the staffing. Obviously, the smart way is to reduce the prison populations by not putting so many people in prison who don't need to be there. Mm.
Lawrence Bartley, how did these issues that Doran Larson is speaking of, how did that affect your 27 years in prison, and how does it affect you now?
Well, during my time in prison, I've seen both sides of it. You know, the guards and wardens and superintendents and commissioners, they are there to control, and they're seen as in this controlling type of setting, this stern type of demeanor towards people incarcerated. But after years of dealing with prison administrators, then there's moments of humanity that come out. And I've learned that not all guards and not all prison administrators want what's bad for you. You know, some of them don't like the rules that they have to enforce. You know, and I've seen a presentation given a few months ago from a prison administrator in Illinois. He did this national study, and he found that correctional officers have a very high rate of suicide. Mm-hmm. And that's because they're taught to deal with situations in such a stern, adverse way. And like Doran mentioned and the caller mentioned, they have to go home. They take that home. And that does something to them. You know, while I was incarcerated, I saw this correctional officer who would open his gate that I had to pass through on the regular, and he would always say good morning. He smoked a cigarette every day. He would say good morning. He was always nice. And then I was shocked one day to find out that he took a pistol and ended his life. Mm-hmm. And so when I heard about this study that correctional officers deal with distress that they have no outlet for, no counseling for, and I know why. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think the way correctional officers are trained and taught to control, that should change. And those who are not vilifying people who are incarcerated and would like to have more of a human type of interaction, those people shouldn't be vilified. Those people shouldn't be seen as outcasts. Those people should be supported.
Lawrence Bartley, it's such an important point. Doran Larson, speak to that. This high rate of suicide among correctional officers and really the trauma that they face behind the bars.
Yeah, the system as it is really does damage to everybody who works inside. So incarcerated people, their life expectancy drops by 2 years on average for every year they're inside. And correctional officers have a life expectancy between 10 and 15 years shorter than everybody outside. And the reason is not just suicide, but high rates of hypertension, alcoholism, and incredibly high rates of domestic violence. Mm. So the system does damage to everyone, precisely for the reasons that Lawrence outlined, the fact that it is primarily a punishment and control system. And when people, we can go back to studies of apartheid or the Holocaust or, you know, other situations of, you know, really, really drastic confinement, the keepers are damaged by the system as much as the kept are damaged. And, you know, we really need to, you know, as mentioned, make more humane prisons, and that really starts with smaller prisons so that you can actually afford to have human relationships between staff and incarcerated people. And it's not just that people are drawn to prison work who have some sort of proclivity for violence or for power. Most people who end up in the prison staff, they're there because it's the local job. Hamilton College, where the archive started and where I've been working for 22 years, we have three prisons in this county. It's the major employer. That's because farming is not a viable future for anyone. Manufacturing has gone away. And so the state in the 80s, with the rise of the war on drugs and Rockefeller drug laws earlier on, found that they could spread jobs across the countryside by building more prisons and locking up more people. And this has been a major job stay for rural white folks across the country.
I appreciate it. It's a really important point. I want to jump in here and get Mark on the line before we go to break in Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
You bet. Go ahead.
I just want to share my experience. 15 years ago, I had the unfortunate misstep of getting a DUI, and I
had the pleasure of staying 2 days in jail in Issaquah, Washington. And I have to agree, it's just a real shame that there's no rehabilitation. There's no nonfiction books in the library. If you miss your commissary, you're out of luck. Everybody is sedated. It's a waste of humanity. And that's all I have to say about that.
Mark, thank you so much. Lawrence Bartley, what do you want people to learn to know by watching The Zoo?
There was a friend of mine who was in solitary confinement for, you know, he did something he should not have done. And he did something he should not have done further. And he was on a restricted diet. And his family, his sister would come see him and he would tell him, listen, this is the way I'm being treated. And she didn't believe him. And so The Zoo is a way of putting these stories out here for families to believe. And at the same time, it's a way of kind of highlighting stories so correctional officers could see what it's like to really, from the perspective of someone who is incarcerated. And all correctional officers aren't bad, but those who are on a cusp, they can learn and make it real.
Lawrence, stick with us. Doran Larson, I want to say thanks to you for the American Prison Writing Archive. Really appreciate your time today sharing it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Listeners, we'll be back discussing life behind bars. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about life in prison in a new, fascinating animated video series called The Zoo. Here's an excerpt. In this clip, we hear how prisoners try to manage their unpredictable life in prison.
After weeks or months of enduring the upheavals of The Zoo, new prisoners slowly begin to adapt. They cling to any opportunity to exert control over their own lives, no matter how small. In a bid to impose order, some prisoners begin painstakingly documenting their own lives.
I kept notes for everything. Notes on colors, names, words that look confusing, emotions, social protocol. Should I ever meet another human being, I'd be ready. Books, magazines, quotes, phrases, you name it, I probably have it in a note.
That's an excerpt from The Zoo. With me this hour, Lawrence Bartley. He's director of News Inside for the Marshall Project, and he was involved in helping to write and produce the video series The Zoo. Lawrence spent 27 years in prison before being released in May of 2018. Joining me now from New York is Molly Crabapple. She's an artist, journalist, and author. She illustrated and produced the animated videos in coordination with the Marshall Project and First Look Media. She's author of Drawing Blood and Brothers of the Gun. Molly, great to have you with us.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, the animated videos are very engaging, dare I say mesmerizing, and a lot of it is because of your work artistically. They tell us how they work. They feature this camera sort of above the page as you're painting?
Sure. Well, me and my collaborators, Kim Bookbinder and Jim Batt, have developed this style for the last 7 years where we do stop motion animations. I will draw for 20 hours. Jim will film it, and then Jim and Kim will painstakingly edit it so that the movements of my hand sync up perfectly to the script.
And why was this an interesting or important artistic mechanism to use for this particular animated feature?
So many Americans are incarcerated, but people whose lives aren't touched by that, people who have never been inside or people whose family members have never been inside, they don't realize the horror of what prison means. And cameras aren't generally allowed in prisons. It's a highly censored environment. You only have the words of prisoners, and prisoners' integrity is so degraded in our society. we wanted to create something that didn't just show, you know, the horrors of prison, but that showed it in a visceral way that would get past people's defenses, that showed it emotionally as well as just intellectually.
And so why was it important for you to be part of this project?
I think that mass incarceration is one of the greatest sins in America, and I want to use my art to fight against it.
Let me get a caller in here. Gordon is in Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Gordon. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment comes from that I worked in prison, and the person who was just speaking, I think a lot of people, specifically middle-class white people who have no connection to prison, have no idea what it is, and you know, it's something to watch on TV and feel that there's some awareness. But really what's happening is it is entirely the way our society is organized to take marginalized people who their chance of success is very different than, you know, people who aren't born into that environment. And, you know, and so it just continues because it's apparently so invisible, even though we are paying for it in our tax dollars. And so I just want to say my point is this, that prison is essentially like purgatory. And so if you have no connection to prison, just imagine your high school cafeteria and being there and trapped there with everyone there is no one you can trust. And violence could happen at any second. Someone will punch someone. Blood will be spilled. It will get cleaned up. And, you know, and another day will go by and you have no idea because every day is just like the next day.
Gordon, thank you. Molly Crabapple, talk about what Gordon describes and the imagery you tried to portray in the zoo.
Gordon's comment is very astute. With drawing the zoo, we were trying to do this mixture of doing, as Gordon said, a visual representation of how same prison life is, right? You know, same uniforms, same bars, the sensory deprivation of solitary confinement, while also using my art to show the sort of surrealism that happens when someone's mind starts to break down because they're in this irrational, cruel system.
Let me play this clip from the zoo. Prisoners uncovered how officers in the prison would game the system in order to get time off. So here's that part. This is part two of the zoo.
Sometimes prisoners are given jobs keeping records of the prison, and then they uncover prison officials gaming the system or abusing the rules.
I knew an inmate who was tasked with logging staff absences for official documents. One of these files revealed the gross abuse of various leaves of absence used by staff. Two officers used every excuse available, such as bereavement, sick leave, personal time, etc., to pile up over 50 days off each for just the first 6 months of 1 year. My buddy found it so amusing, he started charting sick leave usage of all officers on days of the local sports game schedule. Yard lockdowns were so routine on home game days that inmates planned for these periods. Supervisory staff is not only aware of these absences, they participated in them. If such misuse of leave occurred in any civilian workplace, heads would roll.
Lawrence Bartley, your response to that one.
Oh, well, that story came from someone in another state, and I can see how that could happen where he is, possibly. But in New York, my experience comes from New York State. Something like that doesn't happen nowadays. Mm-hmm. It could have happened about 10, 15 years ago, but that comes from a system where the people who have control are able to manipulate it in ways to their benefit. And when there's no accountability up high, then they can do all that. And the person who's down low, the incarcerated person, would see it as a hypocrisy where he or she is meant to be accountable for every little thing that he or she does, but those above are not.
You know, we're talking about prison being like the Twilight Zone, the zoo, right? And how it's hard for prisoners to find time to self-reflect and to change, right? To get out a different person. But you, Lawrence, you're a success story. You earned a college degree in prison and a master's degree. How did you manage? Why are you different than so many?
Well, I think that there are many people like me, but people are just now starting to get the opportunity to show what they can do before they've been blocked. One of the callers, Gordon, I believe he said that there's no one in prison that you can trust. That's not true. There's many people I would trust with my children in prison. There's some people I wouldn't. Just like in free society, there's a mixed bag of everyone is a mixed bag, but there's a mixed amount of people in there. Some people have issues, some people don't. While I was on the inside, I went from, as you mentioned, I went from a GED to a master's degree, and in large part, the way I was able to do it is I had all these pressures that you hear from the Zoe, but then I fought back against those pressures psychologically with using a method that's in one of the other anecdotes, which is note taking. Hmm. I would take notes all the time based upon things that I saw that gave me ideas. I said, I could do this or I can do that. And my ideas was not only meant to be born in a prison setting, it was meant to be born in the outside world when I got out.
When you got out, yeah.
Right. And then I had books and books of notes by the time I got out. And for me, that was a way of fighting back against this feeling and the sentiment that I was no good, but I was telling myself that I am, and I have these ideas, and I have a brain, and I can do some positive things.
I really appreciate that story, Lawrence. Thank you. Let's go back to the phone. Sarah in Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Sarah. You're on the line.
Hi. I just wanted to say I agree entirely with what Lawrence is saying. There's good and bad people. I was in the federal system, which means we have to do 100% of our time. And I was in Lexington, Kentucky, where a serial rapist officer was on the loose. And it took 3 years to get this guy. Mm. This is all told in Handcuffs in the Sand. It tells everything about each federal prison. And there's good guys, like I said, and bad guys. And there were people trying to help the victims, you know, and there were other people, inmates and officers, who were threatening them, saying, you say anything else, this and that. And they were threatening. And there is tremendous stress in prison, but you can get through it. And I agree with Lawrence, you need to write and educate yourself. I was already college educated when I went to prison. I had taught college math at 17, so I taught GED in there. Mm. You try and help other people, and you do learn through those experiences that people are valuable and that there are good and bad people. Mm. And like I said, if you read that 500-page book, it will tell you everything about federal prison.
Sarah, yeah. Thank you very much for the call and your thoughts in federal prison there for 5 years. Chris is on the line now from Columbus, Wisconsin. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hi, and thanks for having Lawrence on. I was a correctional officer for 15 years, and then I went back to school and became a nurse, because the whole time I thought I was supposed to be helping people, but I realized I really wasn't helping anybody while I was an officer, no matter which avenue I tried, whether I tried to be strict or whether I was the compassionate listening officer. My job was just to keep people safe. It is really the parents at the young age, and unfortunately not as many parents listen to this program as need to, and the teachers and clergy that visit inmates that actually facilitate positive change. And I heard many older inmates telling the new inmates coming in, hey, boy, you got to get your learn on. And that was the phrase I heard over and over and over. And it is absolutely true, because if you're not going to educate your children, if they don't educate themselves at a young age, then it's up to the prison system to do it. And the staffing problem is absolutely true. I had to call in sick many times just to get a day off, because I got ordered to work overtime so much. Mm. Thank you for having the show.
Hey, Chris, thank you. Thank you for calling from Columbus, Wisconsin. Let's get one more in here. Ruth from Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Ruth.
This is Ruth.
Hello. Go ahead, please.
Yes, and I just wanted to applaud you for having this program and what your speakers are telling us about. I run a nonprofit organization that's been providing structured programming to women and men who are in custody for the past 15 years inside most of Nebraska's 10 prisons. And the reason this is so vital to our communities and to the nation is something that hasn't yet been said, and that's the fact that basically everyone who is currently in custody will be released one day, and they'll return to their families, our neighborhoods, and communities. And it just seems to us that the best thing to do is to establish relationships with men and women who are in custody. We do this by going into the facilities to provide structured programming. And then after people are released, we extend and expand that relationship by working with them post-release. Many of the people that have been through our program volunteer with us. And half of our staff have been in custody before.
Ruth, thank you. Lawrence, pick that up, because this rehabilitation piece is something that is so important, and I know that you're passionate about.
Absolutely. And rehabilitation largely comes from within. If a person wants to rehabilitate his or herself, a person incarcerated will seek that out and even create its own. There's a friend of mine named Julian Castillo who wanted to help people learn their GEDs, get good in math and reading and writing. And he would try to propose to get a class done, but, administration wouldn't allow him to. So he would go in the yard with his books and have a group of guys there and help them, get their work done and help them learn. And then administration took notice, and then they created these classrooms. And then now he helps hundreds of people get their GEDs to this point. And I tell that story because sometimes prison administrators are slow in order to recognize the good in something. But once they catch on, I like to applaud them for catching on and for making it happen. And what the last caller mentioned about having people who are impacted by the system actually work in these organizations to help and bring forth rehabilitation, that's a very, very important point, because people who went through the process, they know how to get people through, and they know how to connect with people in a way that others can't. Not that they're better than other people, but they have the secret sauce in order to make it happen, and they know when they're being told a lie, because they told those or saw it before. So it works best for everybody if people who have been directly impacted are on board.
Molly Crabapple, wrap us up here. What's your takeaway from this project? You were the illustrator and you produced these animated videos, The Zoo. What's your takeaway?
I think that Americans who aren't touched by incarceration, they have to learn about it. It's incumbent on them. I think that we have more of our population imprisoned in America than any other country in the world, and yet their experiences are unknown to most people who have not been imprisoned. And what I hope that this series can do is I hope that it can make those people listen to the voices of those who have been inside.
Well, I find this work, your work, inspiring. Molly Crabapple and Lawrence Bartley from The Zoo. Thanks to both of you. Really appreciate your time today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Listeners, continue the conversation. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Really appreciate you listening today. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.